The headlines: Russia threatens to sever ties with the European Union if the bloc hits it with economic sanctions. UN agencies warn that at least 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of 5 could die of starvation this year if there is no urgent intervention. Protesters in Myanmar hold new rallies against last week's coup by the army. Hello and welcome, everybody. Russia says it's ready to sever ties with the European Union if the bloc hits it with economic sanctions.
We assume that we are ready to sever ties in case we see again, as we have felt more already, that sanctions create risks for our economy, are imposed in most vulnerable areas. Yes, if you want peace, prepare for war.
Lavrov said Russia does not want to isolate itself from global life, but it has to be ready for possible sanctions. The Kremlin has echoed similar comments. It said Moscow needs to be ready to replace any of its vital infrastructure with elements it may be deprived of by sanctions. The EU reportedly plans to impose travel bans and asset freezes on allies of the Russian president. That will be in response to the last week's expulsion of German, Polish, and Swedish diplomats from Moscow. Russia said they had taken part in illegal protests against the detention of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Ukraine says that two of its soldiers have been killed in clashes with pro-Russian forces in the east of the country. The defense ministry said one soldier was killed by heavy machine gun fire, while another shot by sniper fire, both in the Flashpoint Donetsk region. Ukrainian forces have been battling with pro-Russian groups in Donetsk and Lugansk regions since 2014. Meanwhile, the United States and some European countries have accused Russia of blocking any solution to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. They also accused Moscow of violating international law. But Russia rejected the claims and accused Ukraine of failing to implement the Minsk agreement. The accord was clinched in February 2015 to put an end to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Geopolitical analyst Greg Simon says the U.S. is trying to halt the rise of Russia as a power in what he calls a new Cold War.
It's an attempt to try and block Russia from asserting what it wants to achieve in terms of its foreign and security policy through the use of deceptive discourse and representational force. This new Cold War is an attempt by the US using this words and images to affect the cognitive realm of different actors. So it's an attempt to maintain or hold on to their position of hegemony and prevent other powers from rising.
Official data shows Britain's economy shrank by nearly 10% last year on the fallout from the pandemic. The Office for National Statistics said the fall marked the largest annual drop in gross domestic product on record. Its data shows that Britain's economy has remained 7.8% smaller than its pre-pandemic level. That comes despite two successive quarters of growth in the second half of 2020. Finance Minister Rishi Sunak has said the economy experienced a serious shock. He said the current lockdown continues to have a significant impact on many people and businesses. Much of the UK re-entered lockdown in early January to curb a new COVID variant that's more transmissible. Professor of Economics Steve Keen believes that government policies are to blame for the economic losses in the UK as they failed to bring the pandemic under control.
The UK's performance is probably a case of the worst of both worlds. Driven largely by extremely bad government policy, which has been driven more by attempting to be popular with the populace rather than working out what is necessary to control a pandemic. Well, the main thing is to provide the finances people need. So you give people a cash flow that means they don't go bankrupt because they can no longer go to work. That's absolutely essential, particularly for low-paid workers in the UK. There are outrageous numbers of workers simply have no choice but to go to work because their pay is so bad in the first place. That's an absolute priority. But certainly got the most incompetent government in the world in the UK.
On this news review, four UN agencies have warned that at least 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of five could starve to death this year amid the Saudi-led aggression and the coronavirus pandemic. The warning came from the World Food Programme, the Food and Agriculture Organization, UNICEF, and the World Health Organization. The agencies projected that the number of children under five suffering from severe acute malnutrition would rise by 22% this year compared to 2020. Around 1.2 million pregnant or breastfeeding women are also estimated to be acutely malnourished this year. The UN says Yemen is grappling with the world's worst humanitarian crisis. It has warned that Yemen is in imminent danger of the worst famine the world has witnessed in decades. The impoverished country has been suffering from a Saudi-led war and blockade since 2015. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have author and activist Robert Fantina, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. We also have former lecturer at Westchester University, Lawrence Davidson, joining us from Westchester. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Fantina in Kitchener. What does this warning mean?
It's a very stark warning. It means that the world needs to attend to this and act to save these innocent children. And this doesn't even count the adults who are at risk of starvation. Saudi Arabia has been attacking and savagely destroying the people of Yemen for several years now with the complete support of the United States. President Joe Biden has said he will no longer support the Saudi onslaught of Yemen, but that's not enough. The United States needs to act along with the rest of the world community to provide food and the infrastructure that these starving children need, and it needs to do it now.
Mr. Davidson, your thoughts on the issue. What our guest in Ontario just mentioned, the new U.S. administration has already said that it will cut its support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, but those words are not enough. We need to see action.
Well, your guest is right. It's not enough. What Biden is doing is balancing, essentially, the starvation in this case against the what he considers to be the interests the United States has in continuing relationship with Saudi Arabia. So what he does is he says, okay, we will no longer lend military support or intelligence support for the Yemen civil war or the Yemen war, because I made a promise to do that, and I've got a lot of people in my country who are against it and stuff like that. However, now we've got this other half of the story, and that is the United States has a long-term relationship with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has zillions of dollars of investments in the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. And weighed against that, Biden doesn't feel he has any obligation to save 400,000 or whatever it is starving people. That's not in the deal. So that's the way it's going to be. The United States will not go beyond this, beyond the present situation, except maybe increasing food aid and that kind of thing.
Mr. Davidson, I'm going to stay with you. A guest that we spoke to earlier here on Press TV said that there will be no end to the plight of the Yemeni children as long as Saudi Arabia and its allies are not identified as culprits and are not held accountable. Do you see it in that light as well?
That's right. I mean, and the only ones who can effectively do that are the United States and Western Europe, the Western European countries, and essentially they've got business interests. It comes down to that, and the fact that Saudi Arabia is a big sustainer of the of the American corporate military entourage. So in that case, they'll just let it go on. In other words, how a nation sees its national interests, at least in the case of the United States, is a function of powerful lobby groups, okay? But there's no principle here. I mean, you can talk about the principle, but when you go to make the policy, you're going to be held back by which interest groups you're going to cater to. So, okay, we cater to the moral and the humane elements within these interest groups, and we stop supporting, we stop giving intelligence, and we pull back our naval ships and whatever. But when it comes to naming names and putting the pressure that's needed to get the Saudis to stop what they're doing, no, that's not in our interest, because there's these other lobby groups that say, hey, you know, we're talking about $1 zillion a year for these guys. And that's the way it is.
Mr. Fantina, give me your thoughts.
I agree completely. The fact that 400,000 children may die of starvation and the U.S. doesn't care is not unprecedented. We have to remember when several years ago now, Madeleine Albright was asked about the death toll of children due to sanctions in Iraq. About 500,000 children were estimated to have died because of those U.S. sanctions, and she said it was worth it. So it was worth it for the U.S. to achieve its geopolitical goals, which is what your other commentator has stated. And the U.S. isn't going to allow the blood of 400,000 children, innocent children, starving to death, to prevent it from doing all it can to reach those goals, no matter how unjust and how really abominable they are. Saudi Arabia will continue to decimate the people of Yemen because it makes good dollars and cents for the United States, and that is what the United States looks like, dollars and cents and power.
And Mr. Fantina, one last question for you. Do you think that mainstream Western media has failed the people of Yemen?
Oh, absolutely. The people of Yemen are, and have been for years, suffering. The amount of starvation there is just mind-boggling, and we seldom hear about it in the mainstream media. There's an occasional article, occasional report, but this is a major, as the UN said, it's the worst humanitarian disaster in the world right now, and the mainstream media would rather cover the impeachment, at least in the United States, or what movies are popular, that sort of thing. People are not looking at this, and it is a major failure of the media throughout much of the world.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Robert Fantina joining us from Kitchener. Also thanks to Lawrence Davidson joining us from Westchester. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Yemenis have held a protest rally in front of the United Nations office in the capital, Sana'a, to condemn the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition of the international science. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali, has more.
The U.S. detains oil ships is the slogans chanted by protesters in a rally held in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The protesters condemned the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition and demanded their release.
We hope that the new U.S. administration would lift the blockade on Yemen, but unfortunately it seems it is following the same policy. Not a single liter of oil derivatives has been released over the past weeks. The suffocating siege has deprived millions of Yemenis of fuel and deteriorated their life conditions.
The fuel crisis has deeply impacted the health sector of Yemen, as major hospitals like Al-Thawra and Sana'a are on the verge of closure due to lack of fuel to provide health services.
Our health sector is negatively impacted by the siege. Some hospitals have stopped offering services due to lack of fuel. Intensive care rooms do not work any longer. The siege is targeting the lives of our nation. We call on the world to step in and put an end to this crisis.
12 Yemeni oil vessels are still detained by the Saudi-led coalition contributing to the humanitarian crisis in Yemen that is on the brink of famine due to the Saudi-led war underway since 2015.
Yemenis blame the United Nations for its inaction against the Saudi Arabia's illegal detention of oil ships. They say the UN inaction contributes to Yemen's deprivation of oil derivatives stored on the ships. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
An Israeli settler has driven his car into a group of Palestinian hikers near the occupied West Bank city of Tubas, killing one person. The victim is a 52-year-old Palestinian man. Several people were also seriously injured. The vehicle ramming attack took place in an area between the villages of Ain al-Baida and Bardala in the Jordan Valley. The Israeli military immediately arrived at the scene and claimed it will investigate the incident. However, it also claimed that the incident was merely an accident. In a similar fashion, a Palestinian worker was killed on Wednesday after an Israeli settler rammed his car into him near the West Bank city of Salfit. Protesters in Myanmar have held new rallies against the last week coup by the army and its detention of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The rallies have been held in several cities, including the largest city, Yangon. Clashes have broken out in some locations. They reportedly left three people wounded. Arrests have been made too. Friday marks the seventh straight day of anti-coup protests in Myanmar. Demonstrators want the army to relinquish power and release civilian leaders, including Suu Kyi. Meanwhile, some government employees, including teachers, are still on strike despite the army's call to return to work. The military seized power over voter fraud in November's elections that Suu Kyi's party won by a landslide. Iran has reported 58 new coronavirus fatalities, raising the overall death toll to more than 58,800. Health Ministry spokeswoman Sima Saad Adlari said over 7,200 new cases were also registered in the past day. The figure brings the overall infection tally to more than 1.5 million. Over 1.2 million people have so far recovered from the deadly disease. Iran has implemented strict coronavirus measures. Since November, the restrictions have resulted in a relative decline in the number of deaths and infections. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. You're about to hear under the heading Graphs Show That Black Scientists in the United States Are Underrepresented at Every Level has been authored by Betsy Ladyzetz, who is a freelance science writer based in Brooklyn, New York, United States. Stay with us for more of Betsy Ladyzetz's article. Nationwide protests in the United States in response to the police killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other unarmed black men and women in the first part of 2020 inspired calls to action within academia's ivory tower. Social media movements brought attention to discrimination faced by black students and professionals throughout the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics pipelines. U.S. black residents studying and working in STEM fields are underrepresented at every level, from undergraduate degree programs to the workforce. The academic environment fails to support black students, says economist Gary Hoover at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, Black students in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics are some of the most talented people around. And if the environment isn't going to be welcoming, these folks just take their talents elsewhere. More US students are getting science and engineering degrees than ever before. But the gap for Black and African American students in these fields has been stubbornly wide, as population-adjusted figures show. In 2018, the most recent year for which data is available, about 238 of every 100,000 U.S. residents earned a science, technology, engineering, and mathematics bachelor's degree. If the Black community was adequately represented in science, technology, education, and mathematics higher education, its rate would be similar. 238 of every 100,000 Black residents would have earned these degrees. Yet only 161 of every 100,000 Black residents had done so. The gap continues into graduate school. In 2018, African American residents were 12.3% of the U.S. population, but only 8.4% of bachelor's graduates, 8.3% of master's graduates, and just 5.5% of doctoral graduates. From 2000 to 2018, the rising number of African American students in U.S. science, technology, engineering, and mathematics degree programs mirrored the upward trend of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics students overall. But the representation gap held firm. Displaying the graduation figures by population makes clear that Black students are earning science, technology, engineering, and mathematics degrees at lower levels than Black people are represented in the overall U.S. population. African American science, technology, engineering, and mathematics students make their way up the academic ladder, they may face learning and research environments that are unsupportive or actively hostile. In a 2018-2019 study by the American Institute of Physics, Black students in physics reported that they commonly experience a lack of financial support, as well as microaggressions, small interactions in which peers or superiors question a person's presence or performance due to racially charged bias. These experiences negatively affected the person's sense of belonging in the field. The study results were based on a survey of 232 students, 53 of whom identified as Black or Black biracial. In the survey, 42% of Black physics students reported that their department creates a supportive environment most times, compared with 53% of their white colleagues. 4% of the African American students reported that their department never creates a supportive environment. None of the white students selected this response in the survey. As I reflect on my own academic journey, there were fewer and fewer Black students in my program, says anthropologist Stephanie Poindexter of the University of Buffalo in New York. Stephanie Poindexter was one of the very few Black students studying primates in her undergraduate program, and representation narrowed further as she progressed towards her PhD. What I see is a lot of untapped potential, Poindexter says. Interested students of color who are not fostered into higher degrees in the same way that other students are fostered. Within the United States, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics workforce, Black scientists are also underrepresented, as are Hispanics and Latino and Native American scientists, according to a 2017 official government data. In 2017, black residents, Hispanics or Latino residents, and Native Americans and Alaskan Natives were severely underrepresented among U.S. scientists, engineers, and healthcare professionals when compared with the overall populations for these identities. Among 11 science, technology, engineering, and mathematics professionals reviewed by the National Center for Science and Engineering Statistics, or NCSES, only one field demonstrates a rate of black representation that is close to the overall population. 92 of every 100,000 black residents are social scientists, compared with 122 of every 100,000 U.S. residents overall. The disparity is especially severe in engineering. For example, 29 out of every 100,000 U.S. residents are chemical engineers, compared with 2 of every 100,000 black residents. Young black potential engineers have few role models that look like them and or come from similar backgrounds that they can emulate, manifesting in a deficit in the younger students cultivating these skills, says Aaron Kyle, a senior lecturer in biomedical engineering design at Columbia University's School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Aaron Kyle also notes that minority scientists may be cited less than their peers, leading to challenges in career advancement. Among U.S. engineers, black representation is lowest in chemical engineering. Disparities in salary are found in most, but not all, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields. Computer science has the largest disparity, with a median annual salary in 2017 of $97,000 for white professionals, compared to just $72,000 for black professionals in computer science. There are so few working black mathematicians that the NCSES couldn't even make a comparison. Once employed, U.S. black science, technology, engineering, and mathematics graduates tend to be paid less than their colleagues from other racial backgrounds, according to 2017 data. When black students shift to other tracks, black communities suffer from a lack of doctors, lack of researchers and engineers who directly understand their experiences and needs. To improve black representation in science, Poindexter, Hoover and Kyle all say that solutions must include new offerings of grants, promotions and other research programs dedicated to supporting black science, technology, engineering and mathematics students from elementary school into the workforce. According to Poindexter, there needs to be a concentrated effort and financial commitment to balance the scales in the next 1 to 5 years.
Today. Iran's modernization began in the early 20th century, and by 1979, when the Islamic Revolution took place, the country was comfortable with all modcons and up to its teeth with military equipment. But it was petrodollars buying all that comfort and security with no backup. That is to say, the country lacked enough know-how or heavy machinery to manufacture all that equipment once it was exhausted, if relations with the West soured. Iran felt powerless. To gain independence from powers to the East and West, it erupted in revolution. The leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, returned from exile in France to take the reins of the country. January the 31st this year marked the anniversary of his return. Iran is naturally a land of abundance, but this ancient civilization had its day in antiquity. Modernity is of the West. Iran has tried to catch up, however, and has taken long strides over past decades. But how far has the country gone in international terms, by international standards? How hindering have hurdles been, and what challenges does it face today? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faromazi, on Iran Today. Political, economic, and intellectual independence would not be possible without the expansion of knowledge and science, the Imam reckoned. So he continued the path of modernization with what would appear to be the boldness to attempt sudden nativization of technology. Rather, it was a sudden attempt, but discovery and invention, even reverse engineering, take their own time. But in time, in a matter of decades since the revolution, the country ranks 16th or 17th globally in terms of production of science. Iran is actually making 97% of the medicine it needs domestically. And all this is despite U.S. sanctions imposed against this country. Dr. Shahverdi is the Royan Stem Cell Research Facility Chief. He explains how even Royan is working on a cure for the country's most immediate health challenge, COVID-19. We got to meet him at the Royan Center, where people line up in hope of conception.
On the issue of the coronavirus, because of limitations, the Royan Institute took a valuable step to produce animal models in the lab so that they can work as receptors instead of human models and be used as specimens in several medicinal or vaccine-related studies. Thank God this project is in its final stages. We hope that it can help research teams accelerate their studies so the resulting products can hit the market sooner.
Iran has made giant strides in medicine, nanotechnology, nuclear energy, defense and the production of missiles, aerospace technology, and in heavy industries. Iran ranks fourth in the world in terms of production of nanoscience technology and seventh and ninth in terms of biotechnology and aerospace industry, respectively. The Basij, or Popular Mobilization Forces, have branched into all sectors. Here at their scientific headquarters, I'll bring you to a commander to see what the Basij might have done in aid of the country's scientific progress or community. Dr. Rahimi is the Science and Research Basij Organization Chief. His specialty is aerospace, so he can later also get into a little detail with how Iran is doing in that field and whether the tenets of the revolution helped advancement. I refer to the tenet of self-esteem and realization of the importance of national identity, without which the self-confidence for scientific progress and therefore independence will come to naught.
In realizing a scientific Basij, we're taking two paths in parallel. One is promoting science inside Basij itself, which has enabled us to develop scientific and technological infrastructure in the country. It has resulted in creation of some 100 growth, development, and creativity centers across different provinces. 32 student research centers have been set up and are active in the country. 30 centers for support and guidance of applied and subject-oriented research have been established to assess different issues and needs of the country.
I also got to talk to another couple of people at the Basij headquarters, where there was a science exhibition in the run-up to the anniversary of the revolution. The anniversary is the 22nd of Bahman, or 11th of February, 10th of February this year. Mr. Kazemi is with the Basij organization.
We have more than 300 people in this exhibition that Basij organization have supported them. And they come from different provinces, for example, in 32 provinces in Iran. We have gathered in this exhibition in order to show their product to link it to a place or destination they need.
I got to talk a few words with Mr. Afshar over his stall.
I specialized in X-ray imaging systems, devices that are used for inspection in sensitive buildings, customs, and airports. We produce different types of such imaging devices, including for inspecting large trucks, luggages, and cars. These devices have foreign counterparts and are nothing new, but we have localized over 70% of this technology.
Iran has been isolated by Western powers and therefore abandoned by their weaker allies since the revolution. Economic and military sanctions have even bordered onto siege and genocide, given imports of essential items have also been hindered by U.S.-imposed banking sanctions and secondary sanctions. So it's only natural for Iran to take sole credit for whatever it's achieved since 1979 and the war that followed shortly after. That's the eight-year imposed war with Iraq.
One of the goals of these events and exhibitions that are being held is to create self-confidence and to show our capabilities, especially among the youth of the country, who sometimes make appearances at their own expense to showcase different technologies and gain knowledge. If we want to bridge the gap between our scientific power and that of the world in a 30-40-year outlook, we must work on a groundbreaking science in a fast and accelerated manner.
Talking of achievement, here's someone who can give us detail on what the nanotech sector has been doing. That would be Dr. Sarkar of the Nanotechnology Special Headquarters. At the headquarters, he assured me Iran makes and even exports the heavy machinery needed to manufacture nanotech goods. He showed me some products, such as nano concrete bricks, which are lighter but firmer than regular bricks due to their minute, well-melded building blocks. He also demonstrated anti-cancer jabs that are more effective with fewer side effects than non-nano jabs.
Starting at the earlier stage, we actually invested on human resources development, scientific activities, technology development, and diffusion of nanotechnology in our current industry, and producing these products and introducing this product to the market. So right now, I can mention that Iran has not only on scientific activities, but also in production and commercialization in the field of nanotechnology is very successful. I can mention that right now we have more than 300 knowledge-based companies in the field of nanotechnology, which they are engaged in producing nano-based products.
By 2017, Iran had jumped to 16th rank globally in nanoscience. As for the number of articles this country published on nano, Iran stands fourth, with Germany, the UK, and Japan coming after. While we are at scientific rankings and achievements, let's allow Dr. Shahverdi the time to tell us of where stem cells are leading the country.
The Royan Institute has started working in several areas related to curing chronic conditions. The use of stem cells is in the clinical trial test phase around the world. The Royan Institute is using stem cells to treat conditions related to cornea, such as burns or other issues, namely transplantation from corpses or brain-dead patients. We are using stem cells to treat bone, cartilage, and joint diseases. In the case of neurological diseases, we are starting the first phase of trials on Alzheimer's and also are working in the third phase of trials on cerebral palsy in CP children.
Look up at the stars and you'll catch a moon. Iran agrees. A favorite challenge with decision makers here is to send satellites into orbit. And the new Zuljanah rocket is to do exactly that, to put a satellite into orbit after completing test launches. Iran is pleased to have completed the test launch of the satellite-carrying rocket below orbit. The satellite carrier, which uses solid fuel in its first two stages of launch and liquid fuel in the third, can carry a satellite weighing up to 220 kilograms for 500 kilometers. Iran also successfully launched the country's first military reconnaissance satellite called Nur in April 2020, after two failed launches and a launch pad rocket explosion. Dr. Ommi is the Aerospace Research Center chief. He joined Press TV by Skype to answer questions on achievements in his field as well as challenges faced by the scientific community at large.
Exiting the atmosphere is a difficult task and needs an extremely powerful propelling force. It requires technology which not all countries have access to. Thank God this has been done in Iran. Probes are starting to become operational. We are going to launch our ninth probe from the Aerospace Research Center. After a few prototypes, these probes started to send live animals out of the Earth atmosphere to altitude about 120 to 130 kilometers.
About time to give Dr. Rahimi the floor to tell us of aerospace achievements. In 2017, Iran ranked 11th in the world in scientific production in aerospace and ranked first in the region in aerospace scientific output.
In order for us to build a flying device, we would need to go through different phases, including design, test, initial flight, and finally mass production. They imposed targeted sanctions on the high-speed test phase. So, if we wanted to design military devices, we had to perform a variety of other test flights that were not economically feasible or even justifiable. So we established a technological task force that assessed the problems and needs. The task force imported all the test equipment needed. Now, one of the same task forces has become the center that has enabled us to easily manufacture and export test devices to measure speeds between 1/10 of a meter to 10 Mach inside the country.
Plenty more to say, but time to give other media outlets a chance too before returning to our narrative. So do stay with me for the news segment. To get to our three outlets, beginning with Tasnim News. Enemy targeting Iran's scientific progress, the IRGC chief warns. Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, stressed the need for enhancement of Iran's scientific capabilities, which he said have become a target of hostile actions. While political, economic, or cultural power is usually considered a factor behind the independence of nations, the real source of power is scientific independence, the IRGC commander said. Society will grow if a country's scientific resources are developed. Today, the enemies have waged a war against us in all spheres, including medicine, food, water, and medical care, the commander warned, adding that determination and efforts would turn the hostile threats into opportunities for progress and development. Tehran Times reads, Iran ranks 14th for top universities worldwide. Iran ranked 14th among 102 countries for the highest number of top universities, as 46 Iranian universities were listed on ISC World University Rankings of 2020. ISC is the third internationally accredited citation center established in the Islamic Republic of Iran, based on a resolution adopted in 2008 by the fourth meeting of the Islamic Ministers of Higher Education in Baku, the capital of the Republic of Azerbaijan, to index, evaluate, and publish scientific productions in Islamic countries. There are 2,182 universities from 102 countries in the ranking, of which 46 universities are from Iran, ISNA reported. In 2019, Iran participated with 43 universities, which shows an increased share in the recent ranking. We've got IFP News, which says peaceful nuclear work aimed at boosting national welfare. That's regarding Iran, obviously. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, AEOI, says the achievements secured in the country's nuclear industry are geared to the welfare of Iranians across the nation. Ali Akbar Salehi said peaceful atomic works are in line with the objectives of the human community, moving on the path to achieving peaceful nuclear technology and enjoying the accomplishments, advantages, and benefits of the nuclear industry are aimed at achieving human goals and creating welfare and comfort at the national level. He said among the blessings of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution of Iran and the establishment of its republic have been to reach self-sufficiency, boost domestic capabilities, and pushing back the frontiers of science and technology. And that will be it for the news segment, but the show's still on, so do stay with me. Iran benefits from 3.5 million students. It's no wonder the country managed to promote its rank from 54th in 2005 to 16th in 2019. A point that raises curiosity is the matter of women. Interestingly, while in the year 1979, less than 50,000 university students were girls, in 2009, this figure increased by tenfold to 500,000, and the current figure is about 2 million. Today, about 56% of university students are girls. Some say 70%, depending on the field of study. Iran's adult literacy rate stood at over 84.5% in 2013, going by UNESCO figures, compared to 85% worldwide and 78% in neighboring Arab states. Notably, the literacy rate among 15 to 24-year-olds in Iran is as high as 98%, going by 2015 statistics.
It seems that this revolution has brought about the culmination of serious scientific and technological activities in the country. As far as I know, the number of universities and institutions of higher education in Iran is probably only rivaled by a few other countries in the world. Of course, it is true that some may say that we do not need so many graduates. But in general, when the level of education and knowledge of our nation increases, it will definitely help the growth of our country in all scientific fields.
Prior to the revolution, accredited higher education often ended abroad. But now, with more time, Iran has several accredited universities from medicine to engineering and the humanities, many of which are attended by foreign students.
We didn't accept that we are developing country. We wanted to be among the advanced countries, and we invested on that. And the most investment in was that you mentioned, it was the self-belief that we decided, and it was among the top priorities, and actually it was the master plan that Iran should invest on technology development, science generation, and investing on human resources. And that's why before the revolution, in many scientific areas, we had, at the most, we had a BSc degree in the universities. But it was after the revolution that we started to establish MSc programs and PhD program. Actually, most of the scientific branches.
Health-wise, the country's life expectancy has risen from 50 to 75 years of age. And the mortality rate of children under 5 dropped to under 15 per 1,000 births. That's down from 5,185 deaths per 1,000 births pre-1979. Well, the number of doctors has risen drastically. Before the revolution, there were under 6,000 specialists. Now, numbers have increased about sixfold, especially that of female doctors, taking the total of specialists, medical specialists, up to 36,000. This is while Iran's population at the time of the revolution was just over 37 million, and now it's just over 85 million. But to be fair, students were sent to foreign lands well before the revolution, mostly to France, to study medicine in order to return to their homeland and train other students, setting a strong foundation for the future of Iran's medicine, which after the revolution, Iran took to heights. Based on World Bank reports, in 2009, Iran ranked 21st in terms of the quality and number of hospitals. In 2017, Iran was recognized as the second country globally in controlling contagious diseases. UNICEF thanked Iran for its status of sanitation and medical advances.
In the 1980s, our patients used to go abroad to get infertility treatment. Our scientists and researchers in the Academic Center for Education Agriculture and Research and also the Royal Institute started working on the issue in a timely manner. One of the issues is the matter of stem cells. Early studies on stem cells, namely human embryonic stem cells, were established in 1999. We started working in this field in a few years. One of the medical journals specializing in issues of human reproduction introduced the Royal Institute as one of the top 10 centers active in the field of infertility research and treatment. Today, we have more than 70 infertility centers in the country.
A discipline Iran has made remarkable achievement in is nuclear engineering and science, in spite of efforts at sabotage and assassinations perpetrated by foreign elements, say Israel. By 2017, Iran had published 354 scientific articles in the field, thereby rising to 12th rank globally and first rank regionally in nuclear science.
In my opinion, sanctions can be an opportunity as much as they can be a threat. If we have a powerful ideology, the sanctions will certainly become an opportunity for us. This was realized for diagnostic equipment and other technologies I just told you about. These are technologies that we didn't have access to because of the sanctions.
Iran intends its nuclear program to be peaceful, so I'm putting defense in a separate category. Iran's progress in the construction of defense equipment and missiles is also astounding, given its contemporary history of vulnerability. The country is now capable of manufacturing 90% of its defense equipment inside the country, no less. Iran's arsenal of guided missiles is the largest and most diverse in the Middle East. The country has also developed both cruise and ballistic missiles for use in conventional combat, and it has used such missiles to target Daesh or ISIS.
In order to enter the cycle of science and technology of the country and establish a revolution of modern Islamic civilization, we need to focus our thoughts on that civilization. We need to mobilize all our country's elite to be able to use this capacity to promote the country's scientific and technological capabilities.
Following scientific advancement as well as decades of protest, Iran seems to be also winning political victories against U.S. suppression. Due to restoration of sanctions by the U.S. and based on the 1955 Treaty of Amity signed by the U.S. and Iran, Tehran filed a protest to the International Court of Justice, which voted in favor of Iran.
After the Islamic Revolution, we had the feeling that we can work on scientific issues inside the country and have something to say, and be able to have a proportioned exchange in the international interactions. Our researchers and many of our educated youth had this feeling. Before the Islamic Revolution, these people did not have the self-esteem and courage to enter complicated scientific fields.
Our focus having been science today, I must say, science is nothing new to this country and the world of Islam. We may have had a bad 20th century, but this country has risen from the ashes. It is, however, still dusting itself, but it has come a long way, and together with other Muslim countries, it intends to revive the golden age of the world of Islam, the age of Avicenna and Khwarazmi. To encourage a revival, the Mustafa Awards were introduced, and Iran will be presenting the biennial award to laureates in October. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do remember to return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, and to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.